Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, the word is out. They're gonna talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe. There is to know, from masterpieces to deep-fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot.
Broadcasting from the Lush But Not Lavish Studios, located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, normally. It's episode 764, Killers of the Flower Moon. I didn't get a chance to think up a fake title for this one, so my apologies. I'll have to call it by the right name.
I mean, I thought Killers of the Flower Moon Knight was pretty good, given his love for Marvel.
Yeah, that's true. He does love his comic book movies.
He does. I mean, if there's one thing we know.
I feel pretty confident Martin Scorsese has no idea who Moon Knight is.
I bet you his favorite comic book movie is probably like that Captain America TV movie.
I always think it's weird how much Martin Scorsese seems to hate comic book movies, because I always feel like comic book movies are the Westerns of this generation, and he loves Westerns,
enough.
Right?
Yeah.
But most Westerns were awful. Like, were just bad. They were just cheap, lazy, easy things to produce that were wildly popular, and, you know, and there are some exceptions of within the genre of Westerns that are phenomenal, all-time classic films, but
most of them
were awful. I was just
telling someone this the other day. I was saying the same thing, like, he can't pretend that all Westerns were True Grit or Magnificent Seven or Searchers. Like,
right.
It's the same thing. There's really, really good comic book movies, just like there were really, really good Westerns. And then there's a bunch of other stuff.
And then there's Hopalong Cassidy, you know, and which had a place. But, yeah, like if you go back and look at, like, the TV lineup in the 50s, I mean, it's like 60% Westerns. It's insane how many Westerns were made.
Yeah. The whole thing, and we're, of course, just being silly. I don't care if he likes Marvel movies or not. I'm so sick of that whole discourse. But here's the thing. At some point, internet culture got so obsessed with defending their own opinion or attacking other people's opinions that, like, they took major offense. And at the end of the day, it's like, dude, the guy has earned a right to say whatever he wants about movies. And if you don't agree with him, instead of, like, fighting about it and getting mad, just be like, okay, he's got a different opinion. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not affecting the production of comic book movies, so you're going to be okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Boo-hoo, he might not direct a Marvel movie. You know?
Now in my head, I'm trying to be like, oh, what would I want him to direct? Like that.
I almost asked that question on Twitter yesterday because I was going to say, and then of course I decided, why would I even want to tweet? It's a terrible idea from the start. But I was going to say, like, preface it with, I did not ask for the answer. He shouldn't. I did not ask for Martin, you know, whatever. Like, he shouldn't waste his time. No. If he were going to, what would be the character best suited to him? And then I decided, I'm not going to ask this question.
Yeah, that's probably for the best. So before we dig into the movie, we should go around the virtual table because I am traveling. That's why we're doing this remotely. And we can introduce ourselves.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Super simple. No Joe this week. We might or might not have a guest joining us. There might have been some time zone snafus since the three of us would be in three different time zones. So, and since I have to check out of a hotel and then catch a plane, we couldn't wait. So before
just
we dig into the movie,
this is real spoilers.
It's not like it's a clip out. It's real spoilers.
Right,
so like
that's true.
Yeah, like if it was a clip out, things would be moved.
Things
yes,
would shift, reschedule, come home tomorrow. It doesn't matter.
We've got budgets for all that. So, yeah. But before we get into the movie, shameless plugs. Don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, iHeart, TuneIn, wherever you find a podcast. You can find us while you're there. Be sure and follow us so you never miss an episode. Maybe leave us a review. Super helpful. Greatly appreciated. Appreciate it. Also, don't forget, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. It's called the League of Show Shares because we're hoping you will share an episode. People who were kind enough to share an episode over the last 2 weeks, Kevin, include Librarian Cynthia, Brendan McGuckin, Julianne Jordan, Glenn Cougar, Mellon Brewer, Tom Dowdy, Chris Magic Man, Richard Kratzer, Chris Valls, Gabriel Lugo, Phil Timon, Heather Sachs, Dissect That Film, Taylor Ward, Brent Smith, Ralph Tribble, Travis Tewitt, Jason Weesey, Tammy Lynn Powers, Betts, Matt Gonzalez, Matt Naglia, David Rojas, Spoiler Piece Theater, Mike and Oscar, Invasion of the Remake, Colby Mack, Batman Rye Guy, Geek to Me Radio, Ronnie Castle, In Session Film, Binge Movies, Feelin' Film, and Ryan Terry. So thank you very much. We greatly appreciate it. And also don't forget we have a Patreon at patreon.com/realspoilers where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content and we like you extra. So there's all that. Let's dig in. I'm really bummed that we don't have Joe this week since he's really good at synopsisizing the films, and he's a police officer, so he'd be great. This is like Wonder Twin powers activate. He's like just recapping a crime for 3.5 hours.
And he also loves crime mysteries. What is the true crime stories and all that stuff? Yeah, he loves that stuff. He's watched every episode. Like, I've only watched a couple and listened to the first serial. Or, well, listened to the first two. But, you know, I don't catch up with those things as much. And so I haven't read the book, and I also didn't know anything about the story. So I found this film fascinating. I will say, of course, he's getting guff for it being 3.5 hours long or a little longer than 3.5 hours. But especially not knowing the story, I found myself captivated by the entire thing. It felt long. I felt the time, but it never felt boring to me.
It's a lot of story, right? Like you could easily make this movie longer if you wanted to. So and I have read the book. I read it a few years back, so it's not necessarily top of mind, but I have read it. And I honestly, and I don't say this very often, I think the movie might be better. So the movie switches some things up. So the book is really more from the POV of the FBI agent or the BOI agent, because the FBI doesn't technically exist yet, that they send in Jesse Plemons' character. And it's also a little bit more of a murder mystery in terms of like what's going on, who's doing all this, who's behind all this, where I don't feel like this movie ever plays like a mystery. Like you always know who's behind it.
And I was a little confused by that, too. And that's why I don't think this movie's perfect. I do not think it's a masterpiece, as a lot of people are saying. I think that word gets thrown around. And I think whenever someone like Scorsese makes a movie, people automatically think they have to say masterpiece. I think it's a very good movie. But I do think that it feels like it doesn't necessarily have a solid voice and doesn't necessarily, like, if it wants to be a murder mystery, there's not much mystery going on. So it's just, I don't know, it's not perfect to me, but it is very solid.
Yeah, I think it's very good. I liked it. I liked it a lot. I don't think it's necessarily a perfect. It's like, it's not, I wouldn't call it middle tier Scorsese, but I'd call it like lower upper tier.
Yeah, Scorsese. I think this is a solid B. I think it's a B, which is a very good rating for a film.
And I would say a Scorsese B,
Scorsese
not just a rating.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
If it's all
like
relative,
we know,
and he has
right. So, but yeah, like I don't think it's intended to be a mystery because I actually went back and stumbled upon the trailer, and if you watch the trailer, like it's very obvious that who the villain is in the movie, and I can't imagine at this point in his career Scorsese gets to do what he wants to do. So if he wanted that to be a secret, it would not be in the trailer, right? Like he would put a stop to that because he gets what he wants. So
and I do feel that if it were a mystery, though, the film from a narrative standpoint might play out a little better. I wish there were a little bit more mystery, and then sometimes they would flash back and show you the people doing stuff and you're like, I don't need that. Like if you were going to cut time, like I totally understand who did what. Like it was obvious to me and they pretty much told you who was doing what. So that's the part where I'm like, either make it a mystery or don't, but I don't need to spend so much time with you explaining who did it. It's like, I get it.
Yeah, I think, you know, he might be trying to, like, when having read the book, like, there are so many characters to keep track of. Like, I think he's really trying to hold your hand through a pretty complex narrative and a pretty complex mystery, even though he's not making it a mystery. Like, or I shouldn't say mystery, a pretty complex conspiracy. There are a lot of moving parts in this conspiracy. There are, which is part of why it works so well. Also, the fact that everybody was racist and they didn't care. But
right.
But like there are things that like we know now that they didn't necessarily know till years later, like when the one person he hired to kill someone gets shot while robbing a store, like people didn't find out till years later that like, well, he tipped off the owner, right? Like that's not just a quirk of a little cute narrative device to make this guy seem even worse. Like he really did that. Like this, from everything I can read, and we all know that I am an exhaustive historian, but from everything I can read, like this story seems pretty non-fictionalized. Like I don't think they took a lot of liberties with what actually happened, and the story's so bad crazy that you don't need to. Like it's Looney Tunes.
Again, this movie kept my attention, and I didn't know anything about the story. I found it fascinating and obviously deeply tragic that this happened to the Osage Nation's people, and I found myself wanting to learn more because I'm like, okay, this is such a fascinating story. I can't believe this happened. Didn't know anything about it. And I went back and I watched like little PBS docuseries things, YouTube videos. I watched probably an hour and a half, 2 hours of people talking about the history. And this movie is so accurate. I think he did a great service to the people and telling their story because he really did not embellish too many of the details. It's like the things that they were saying, they were telling in the documentaries.
For sure, yeah. And so I guess we should start, like, the movie opens, I think it's 1918, and Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Ernest, is coming to town, and he just getting back from, I guess, fighting... Ernest? Yes. If only Robert De Niro was playing Vern. he's coming back from, I guess, having fought in World War One and looking for work. And he ends up working for his uncle in Oklahoma on the Osage Nation. And we should say, like, I don't, if the movie said this, I don't remember, but like how small and how few Osage there were at this point, right? There were, I think, 2000... just around like 2,229 Osage, I think, existed at this point. And they had been moved by the federal government to just really, really substandard land. And all the Osage were given like pretty large parcels of basically worthless land. But the Osage Nation had was able to negotiate to keep the mineral rights for the land for the Osage Nation itself. And so so the government said yes, not because they were kind, but because they thought, well, that's dumb. There's nothing on this land. And then
let's
it turned
cleanly
out
cleanly wrap this up. Yeah.
Right. And so it turned out that there was oil on that land. And then, I think this happened in the late 1800s. And then of course the automobile industry starts to explode and oil is worth more than it ever had been. And so all the Osage Nation now has the mineral rights to a very, very, very large oil field. And the one article I saw said that in 1923, they produced 33 million dollars worth of oil, which in today's money would be like $500 million. And mm-hmm. all of that money would then be divided amongst the Osage Nation. So you're talking 2,200 people were dividing $500 million annually. So,
yeah, it was it's crazy to think about the way that all played out and the way that the town operated and how they the Osage Nation's spent their money on cars and nice clothes and all that, and they had white servants. I had no idea about any of that, and so I just found that dynamic super interesting and again heartbreaking and tragic, the way that of course people came in and would take advantage of it and ultimately end to the demise of these people, or you know, not totally, but a lot of them, and horrible.
Yeah, I mean, you always hear these stories about like lottery winners that win money and they just don't know how to handle their wealth, and it ends up getting squandered and they get taken advantage of. Well, here you have basically an entire community that won the lottery, for lack of a better term, and then the vultures come in, right? And so and then you start seeing things where the government would declare a lot of the Indians incompetent, so they had to have conservators appointed to quote-unquote protect them from their own decision. So they would have and conservator, you can just, you know, just hear white guy, and then they would need permission from a white guy in order to spend their money, and then this white guy would charge a fee because he's performing a service, and then he would end up siphoning off good chunks of their money in fees, or a lot of times they would end up bequeathing the conservator the money.
Do I need to bleep that?
Yeah. Bequeathing the conservator what they called head rights and to the oil, and then they would die, right? And that happened
that too,
a lot.
Before that, when in the documentaries that I was watching, they would steal it. They would just up and steal it. They would negotiate. Things would be, and you see it in the film with the caskets, there would be an Osage price and there'd be a white man price. And so because they had so much money, they would charge them more for everything. And so essentially they would negotiate deals where they would get kickbacks. A car, a coat, a hat would be five times more. And then the conservator gets half of that. And it's just a big scam to take their money.
Very much so. Very, very much so. And I will say one of my complaints about this movie, just from a historical aspect, is that I think it's really easy for the average person to walk out of this movie and think, oh, William Hale's a bad dude, and thank God we caught him, not really getting the scope of this, that like William Hale, Robert De Niro's character, was doing had created the largest conspiracy and most sophisticatedly malicious conspiracy to kill off Indians in order to steal their money. But he was in no way, shape, or form the only person doing it, right? Like, they're like,
right.
Hundreds of Indians died prematurely during this time frame. And hundreds of people being killed is a lot, but it's even more when you recognize that there were only 2,200 Osage Indians at this point in time, right? So, you know, you're talking 10, 15, 20% of them were killed off for their money. Like, that's insane.
And I think, you know, at the toward the end of the film, when you see the room full of all the white men making decisions, and they're going to try to convince Ernest what to do as far as flipping on them for the FBI and all that toward the end of the movie, you see everyone that's involved. You see Molly's conservator. You see the doctors. You see the bankers. You see everybody in the town, the casket guy. It doesn't matter. And so that just really shows you they were all in on it. And of course, all the people that came into work were, as you see throughout the film, committing crimes and being hired to kill them and steal from them and rob them. And so, yeah, they were all taking advantage of these people.
Yeah, and like, and the white people at that time, I mean, they barely considered Indians human beings, right? Like, they, you know, a lot of them didn't. Like, there was a famous line, I forget who said it, and I don't even remember if it pops up in the movie, but where someone in the while this was going on was quoted as saying, like, well, the real controversy is deciding whether or not to charge them with murder or cruelty to animals, right? Like, that's how little people thought of Indians at that point in time. And then you had a law enforcement community that had absolutely no will, desire, or incentive to even classify these things as murder, let alone investigate them. And like, that was probably Hale's biggest mistake, is that the murders started to really look like murders. And even, and yes, the local authorities would ignore it, but at this point in time, the FBI doesn't exist, right? It's brand spanking new. It's still called the Bureau of
Investigation. This was their first case.
If it's not their first, it's one of them. It's like they were a very new organization. They were still called the Bureau of Investigation. They were headed up by J. Edgar Hoover at this point, and he was very much looking for a high profile case to justify their existence. And this is part of why, like, that classic G-men look of, like, they're always in suits and ties, right? Like, that is that was codified during this period, because J. Edgar Hoover was like, we need to project an era, an aura of professionalism. And so they didn't have uniforms per se, so he was like, we are going to look like business professionals. So, like, it was ordered that every FBI agent or BOI agent would wear a suit and tie, which is why they dressed like that, and due to this day, right? And so like, they were desperately trying to prove that they exist. In fact, this is not the first time the story has been adapted for film. In 1959, there's a Jimmy Stewart movie called The FBI Story, which tells the history of the FBI through a very pro-law enforcement lens, right? And but this story, a very encapsulated version of this story, is told in that film, because this is really this is the origin of the FBI.
Yeah, and again, I thought it was so interesting that all this happened, and I can't believe I hadn't heard about it. I can't believe this isn't something that isn't taught in schools, or maybe they didn't have as much information until more recently.
No, this was not a secret thing, right? I mean, like, in 1959, you're getting a major motion picture about it. There was a TV show called The G-Men, or maybe it was a radio show, and it was like the third episode of that show. Like, this was a huge national news story, right? Not only the murders, but the wealth of the Osage. So, like, there is nothing about this story that was like an anecdote or a footnote, except for the fact that over time we turned it into one. Right. And you have states today trying to pass laws. In Oklahoma, they just passed a law saying that you can't teach history that might make somebody feel bad. Right. And it's like, it's also funny that it's coming from conservatives, who are the first people to wear T-shirts that say "fuck your feelings." Right. Like, we can't make people feel bad about things that actually occurred. And also, there's a lot of alsos here. Keep in mind that this is geographically right next to Tulsa, which is where you had Black Wall Street, where the white people went in and slaughtered all the black people who were starting to amass wealth. And, you know, you have racism take on this kind of snake eating its own tail circular logic to it, where it's like, racists will look at black people or Indians and say, look how poor they are. They're poor because they're not smart. And that's proof, which then justifies me looking down on them, and it all feeds on itself, right? But here are people, like, yes, these money was robbed from these Indians, money was robbed from these black people on top of the murders, but also keep in mind the generational wealth that was stolen, right? The wealth that could have been amassed and passed on. Right, there's all this talk these days about Nepo babies. Think of all the Black Wall Street Nepo babies that never got to exist. Think of all the Osage Indian Nepo babies that never got to exist. You know, and their culture for sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then racists will turn around and say, "Oh, look, they squander their money. They're poor. They can't amass any wealth. It's because they're not as smart as white people are," quote unquote. And it's like, but every time we have non-white groups start to amass that kind of wealth, we would enact a system that would systematically rob them of it, and then look down on them for having been robbed. And then stop teaching ourselves that we robbed them of their money.
Right. And that's the whole thing that gets into the politics. You've got a lot of people now online saying that Martin Scorsese is getting political and that he's taken a bad turn by getting political about it. And it's like, this is the history of what happened. There's no politics if you're just presenting the facts of what happened, and I'm sorry if your politics are trying to cover up the facts of history, but
if you think being anti-murdering people for their money is political, then your politics suck. Like,
right.
Hard stop. Like they were murdering people, and not just people, but like women and children. They were murdering children for their money. Yeah. Sometimes people were murdering their own children. Men would marry an Indian woman and then kill her, but they would have had children in the meantime. Well, the rights would go to the children, so they have to kill the children.
Like that Kelsey Morrison at the end of the toward the end of the movie when he's goes to the banker or the insurance conservator, whoever that was, and he says, so if these two kids were to die and I were to adopt them, then I would get their money. And the guy's like, so what you're telling me is that if you were to adopt these kids and kill them, would you get the money? He's like, well, you're going to do that? He's like, well, not if I don't get the money. That's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's terrible. But those are the things that, I mean, this
and the
movie
scene is like
out.
Yeah, like, and the scene, like, it almost plays for laughs because it's like, it's so over the top ludicrous what the guy is saying that, and how matter of factly he's presenting it, right?
He's
and
playing it straight,
And it's like, it's almost hard not to laugh because it's just so, it's so insane that someone would think like that and also have the balls to say it out loud, like they came up with a good idea. That happened a lot.
Like their property. It's exactly what you were saying. They said these things and they did these things because they literally thought so little of this human life that they were like, oh, this makes sense financially. Why wouldn't I do this?
Yeah. It is crazy what went on in this time and just how much, like I said, just how much by today's standards, probably billions of dollars were robbed from these people. And now this land, the oil's gone, and there are still head rights, and there is some modicum of oil being produced there. But by and large, the low-hanging fruit has been acquired, and there's not really any true value in the same way that there was in the 1920s. And I should also say, in 1925, they actually passed a law that said head rights could only be inherited by someone who was at least 50% Native American because of all the, like, that is how pervasive, like, if anyone's trying to position this or thinking that this was an isolated incident or a handful of isolated incidents, they could not be more mistaken. Like, it was so bad the federal government stepped in and, like, passed a law to make it so basically white people couldn't inherit these head rights because of the frequency of Indian deaths and white people getting the money.
They essentially stole most of their wealth, killed off enough of them where they're, you know, they didn't have as many kids and grandkids as they could have to expand. And you know, they obviously there still are some surviving descendants, but not that many, and certainly not as many as could have flourished had things not gone this way. So it's awful.
Yeah, this story's not as far in the past as people might think. Leonardo DiCaprio's character in real life doesn't die until 1986. Like, that's not that long ago.
And William Hale, who the Robert De Niro character, he lived to be 87. So, I mean, yeah, he died in 1962, but that's not that long ago if you think about it. And what it also shows you is look at these white men doing their terrible things. I'm not – they were white. So, again, it's not political, and I'm white. I'm not trying to be anti-white. Yeah. But the fact
you
is,
can't,
the people committing these crimes...
You can't disentangle race from this, right? You had white people going onto Indian land and concocting a conspiracy to steal their money and then using the laws of codified racism to make it easier. Like, you can't remove race from the equation. You definitely need to specify who's white and who's Indian as this progresses, because it is crucial to the story.
Yeah, and again, there's nothing political about it. These are facts. The people, the villains of the story, so to speak, the bad guys, are the white men who came in and stealed and murdered and did all these terrible atrocities. So, but William Hale lived to be 87. And look at this. You look at Ernest. You look at his brother. You look at Uncle William Hale. They lived to be into their 80s, almost 90 years old. And then the Osage Nation's people were dying in their 20s, their 30s. Like 50 was seeming to be an old age by the average deaths during all this happening for the Osage Nations. So it's terrible when you look at that and then look at these guys that got away with this and their freedom that they were still able to keep to some aspect.
Right. Yeah, like he didn't spend his life in prison. Like he got out. Ernest got out. Now he ends up going back to jail. I don't think the movie says this. He goes back to jail for going and stealing from Indians again. Like he goes back and robs from his sister-in-law and ends up getting sent back to prison.
He got out and had to go back for like 20 more years. Like a lot. You know,
yeah.
He was lucky enough to escape all this after, you know.
Yeah. And I will also say something, an interesting footnote that the movie didn't include, which I think because it probably would have felt fake, right? But William Hale and one of the other guys get sent to Leavenworth, and the brand new warden of Leavenworth is Thomas White. Isn't that his name, Tom White? The FBI agent played by Jesse Plemons. Like, and so
yeah,
like
right.
they
yeah.
end up going to jail, and the warden is the guy who led the investigation that captured them. Like, if you ended the movie on that, it's a little too cute. Like, you'd be like, oh, boy. Like, you know,
yeah, right?
like you would not believe that.
Yeah, that's crazy. And then, yeah, I saw that he was injured. People tried to escape, and he got shot, and, like, he survived it, but I think he lost the use of one of his arms during that.
Yeah.
It is crazy. But so, like, basically the story, just to go back to the plot of the film, is that, yeah, Ernest basically – I mean, he conspires with his brother, who is it Byron, I think, and William Hale, played by Robert De Niro, and they conspire to pick off these Native Americans one by one. And the thing, there's a couple things I don't like about the Ernest character, the way he's portrayed, because he's not a good person. He's doing awful things. He's robbing. He's helping with the murders and all this, but I feel like the movie does try to almost present him as quasi sympathetic, and that, oh, but he kind of did the right thing in the end, but he's not a good person by any means. And I just don't like that it even kind of presents it like he's your, you know, he's one of the heroes of the story, or one of the maybe good guys that was in a bad situation.
I don't know. I didn't really take him as a good guy. I took him as someone – his character's pretty nuanced, and he's he's very conflicted, I feel like. Like, at the end of the day, he's making the wrong choices, absolutely. But at least the way it's portrayed on screen, he seems conflicted. And he does seem to have, oddly enough, love for this woman as he's killing her family poisoning her. Like, in at least the way the movie played it, I don't feel like initially he realized he was poisoning her. Like, I think he thought he was taking care of her with the insulin shots. Like, she's diabetic, and insulin is very new, and William Hale gets medicine for her, and it turns out that they're putting poison in the medicine. And we should also say that, and I don't know if the movie makes this super clear, but like, William Hale was very frequently getting medical assistance for various Indians, which is also part of what makes him so insidious, is that on one hand, is if you didn't have access to money and were an Indian, he did a lot of good things. Right, like he was very much about donating money to Indians, helping them get health care and medical assistance when they needed it. He did all these positive things, but he was doing them so they wouldn't suspect him of this other thing.
Right. It was a con. It was a long con, is what he did. So, yeah, it looked like, and that's why they called him King, was his nickname. He was basically the king of this town, which was ran by, and, you know, the wealthy people were all the Osage Nations, but he was called King, and people looked up to him and acted like he was a friend, and he learned to speak their language, and you would see him communicating with them in a very family-esque way. But he was terrible. And I just have a little bit of a problem where I think the movie presents Ernest, the Leonardo DiCaprio character, as a character that maybe is dumb and doesn't realize what he's doing. But he also says, and the history, the documentaries all check out and everything, that he loved to spend the money and he would rob people. And obviously, when he got out of jail, he robbed people. And he did a lot of terrible things. So I don't necessarily think he was too dumb to know. I think that he was a pretty bad person, and I just think the movie tries to give you an out by saying, well, he was being manipulated, which, I mean, sure, the King seemed like a manipulative character. Surely he was orchestrating this, but I don't know. It just seemed like the way that he would go from dinner with his wife and his family to then going and holding people up and committing these crimes, and then obviously knew his sister-in-laws were being killed off and everything. Like, to allow that to happen, and he knew his uncle and brother were orchestrating this, and he was helping get bombs to blow them up and to do all this stuff. Like, he's a bad person. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And no matter what he does, he's absolutely not redeemed, you know?
I don't really know that the movie's saying that, to be perfectly honest. Like, yeah. I think that the movie's showing you who he is and what he did. And he did do those things, right? Like, he did have positive interactions with his family, and that's part of what makes it so insidious, right? That while he was doing this one nice thing, he was doing these other just off the charts awful things on top of it. And I can't remember if the movie explains this or not, but like, the night of the explosion where he blows up his sister-in-law's house, his kids were supposed to go over there that night, and the only reason they didn't was because the son had an ear infection and they ended up at the last minute not going there, but they were gonna be there. And I didn't interpret it as we were supposed to, like, feel bad for this guy as much as almost the banality of evil, right? That it's like,
yeah,
someone who's evil isn't necessarily evil in every waking moment and every singular action that they take. That there's going to be times when they look normal or even nice. I also wonder if some of that is just baggage that Leonardo DiCaprio as an actor brings to the role. You know,
I was just going to say, I think maybe one of the disservices they do, and I know they want a movie star because they plaster him front and center on all the movie posters.
Sure.
But when you hire Leonardo DiCaprio and he plays it as someone who's sympathetic, like I do feel that the way, again, the language of cinema, the way that they're presenting the story, I interpret it like they show so many of these good qualities, and then it's like he has this kind of heroic, I'm going to turn on you and I'm going to do this. Like, there's a big ending moment where he does the right thing after doing so many terrible things, and it just reads like, but yeah, that's great, and at least you didn't do another bad thing, but you're awful and you're not sympathetic and you ruined your life and many others. So I think
even when he finally turns Stace evidence and testifies against Hale, it's still weird because he agrees to do it. And then he walks it back and recants, and then he unrecants eventually. And he did that in real life. People that were involved still never understood what made him testify, you know? There's a quote from Hale late in his life that was like, if Ernest had kept his dumb mouth shut, we'd all be rich. Which I think is, one, true, and also something to keep in mind when you see some families perhaps who've been rich for generations, that like somewhere in that backstory there could very well be some very ugly choices that were made that cemented their wealth. It doesn't make them smarter. It makes them oftentimes more willing to have done some pretty ugly things.
Yeah.
You know, and when people talk about white privilege, like that's one of the things that they're referring to, right? Like we all benefit from that as to some degree. Like, even indirectly, even if we didn't play a direct role in the decision making, like, we still live in a world where the land structure was set up to benefit us in a way it wasn't set up to benefit other people. I say us specifically, like you and me, Kevin, because we're both white guys. You know?
Well, and look at what's going on with the rest of the world, and now people are being killed for the way that they look, and they're in completely different parts of the world, and they're being stabbed and murdered, and it's like we don't walk down the street thinking that might happen to us.
Right. Yeah,
it's
for sure.
Horrible. When people don't like that word or don't think that white privilege is a real thing, it's like, what world do you exist in? I mean, we absolutely do have privilege, and it's
almost like saying we have an oxygen privilege. It's like, well, you don't realize the privilege of oxygen until it's removed.
yeah, that's a good point. It's just weird when people, again, try to make that like it's political or something, but look at all the people losing their lives and are being targeted and harassed and again, injured, killed, whatever, because of the way they look, and they may have nothing to do with what people think they do, and it's horrible. And, we don't necessarily, you and I don't get a second glance. It's just, well, you're not one of the people that believes in whatever or does whatever. You know, we're not even thought of in that way, right? And that's the privilege.
Yeah, for sure. So, absolutely.
So the story, I mean, yeah, it just goes through them, the three of them, and enlisting people, their co-conspirators, people in the town. So Molly is the woman that Ernest ends up marrying, and it is all but an arranged marriage by King. I mean, he sets them up. He's like, oh, you should, you know, she has these rights once her mother's sickly and one of her sisters just died, and they're gonna share all this wealth, and she's single, and so he kind of sets that up, and the movie does present it in a way where he really does care about her. Like, it is odd because of all the things that he's doing, but from all accounts it does sound like in the history that he was loving to her while he's doing this. And
yeah,
it's a strange thing because I don't necessarily think it's wrong the way it's presented, but it's like, from what I know, he did love her and care for her and take care of her, and all the way up into the fact that when all this started to get unraveled and discovered by the Bureau of Investigation, she didn't believe he could do these things to her and her family,
right?
Because she loved him and believed he loved her and all that.
Well, when she's getting sicker and sicker as she takes this insulin, I mean, what does she say? She turns to Ernest and she's like, only you can give me this medicine.
Right.
You make sure you get it directly off the train. Like, she's like, as long as I remove all variables from the equation except Ernest, I'm going to be okay, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, and it's heartbreaking when we, again, because there's really no mystery, we see how everything's playing out, and he kisses her goodbye and then goes to find hire someone to kill her sisters. Like, we know everything that he's doing, and while her family keeps dying off and she's entrusting him like that, it is heartbreaking and so tragic as she trusts him with her life and her family's lives. And I have to say, I think one of the best performances in the entire film is Lily Gladstone, who plays Molly. She is phenomenal in this film.
I would agree wholeheartedly. A lot. No, she says a lot without saying a lot.
Exactly, which is masterful. That is a skill and something that is very hard to do. And, you know, of course, you've got your detractors who are now looking at word count and stuff like that. That's so stupid and so silly, because there's been actors all throughout the histories of the Oscar who have said very little, and then obviously some that have said speeches and a lot, but it varies wildly. And she, again, says so much with her facial expression, her eyes. She's one of those actors who's really talented in that way. And I think her performance is so subtle and understated in a good way, because there are some performances in this film that are very big, and I don't mean that
DiCaprio's
as a good thing.
DiCaprio's is very big, and he makes this weird face where he looks like he's impersonating Sling. Yeah, it looks like he's impersonating Sling Blade. Like, I don't
think he was trying to look related to De Niro and do, you know, kind of do the scowl that De Niro does. I think that was his way of, oh, well, this is my uncle, so in the bloodline.
Yeah.
I agree. As good of an actor as DiCaprio is, this is maybe one of my least favorite roles of his, and it's weird because he's a good actor, but I just think he played this too cartoony. There was something
It gets a little hammy down the stretch. Yeah. Like, it doesn't start that way, but the more the tension ratchets up, the weirder choices he makes.
But he shows
as an actor.
He shows up on that train looking like Robin Williams and Popeye. Like, he right from the beginning, he's looking around like,
yeah,
it just he is acting with a capital A, and it just I didn't like it. And some people are saying De Niro's cartoony, but I think DiCaprio's way more cartoony than
I don't think De Niro's cartoony in this at all. I think came across as weird is, like, because you don't normally hear him talk with that accent. The only time I ever remember him talking with that accent is his Max Cady and Cape Fear.
Cape Fear.
And so when he starts talking like that, like, I'm instantly like Cape Fear, right? Like, it was hard not to go straight to
when
Cape
he does
Fear.
The, like, oh, my boy. Like, he just, like, he gets that twanginess to him or whatnot.
Yeah. And so I think it's just weird. And I also, like, Cape Fear is a great movie, but I also don't know how many younger people have seen Cape Fear, which is a shame.
I love Cape Fear, the remake of Cape Fear. Yeah,
like, it's so good. And it's just a fun, like, tense Hollywood thriller. Like, it's maybe the most accessible Scorsese movie, right? Like, it's just a fun, tense Hollywood potboiler.
I think next to Wolf of Wall Street, speaking of Leonardo DiCaprio movies, I think Wolf of Wall Street is almost one of the most mainstream as it gets Scorsese wise.
I think Goodfellas is very mainstream, even though it's also still very art house. It's somehow it manages to do both. But
Wolf of Wall Street to me is like an entertaining comedy blockbuster. Like, that seems such a mainstream movie to me.
Yeah. No, I get that.
I bring that up too because there are some people that think Scorsese only makes boring movies, which I don't think long equates boring. I certainly don't agree with that. But then there's some goofball, and what you got to realize is they let anyone open up a Twitter account if you got a dollar, I guess, these days, and you can just say anything. So sometimes we get really, like, taken aback by what people say, and it's like anyone can literally type or record a video of them saying anything. So, like, it's a bad take, but someone saying, like, oh, watching a Scorsese movie is like going to the DMV. You have to do it every once in a while. It's important, but then it's tedious. And it's like, and they used Wolf of Wall Street as the example. That is one of the most high energy, entertaining Scorsese movies ever. Like, I just thought it was crazy.
I agree wholeheartedly. Like, that, like, there's a lot of Scorsese movies that are just a blast, like Cape Fear and Goodfellas
is not one
of his better movies. I don't know that he's ever truly made a bad movie, but like Color of Money, Color Money is definitely lesser, but that's
King of
a
comedy?
Higher King of like King of Comedy is such a dark, bleak comedy that I get why someone might react negatively to it, even though I love it. But
After Hours, it doesn't get much more zany and comedic. Like,
yeah,
that is a funny movie. So I think a lot of people that say this, it just shows like they haven't watched all of Scorsese's filmography because they don't know he made After Hours. And that movie is one of my favorites. It's a blast. It's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. If you're if you're starting your Scorsese journey with Silence, then you're gonna be bored.
And then you never watched another one and you go, he just makes boring movies. It's like that's one of his slower movies. Or Last Temptation of Christ is a slower moving movie.
Yeah,
it's got weird stuff in it. But it's but he makes really entertaining and really funny movies. It's
they can be. I mean, Goodfellas has a lot of comedy in it, very dark comedy. But I mean people it's still quoted to this day. Am I a clown? Yeah. Do I amuse you? You know, the scene where they're showing Joe Pesci's mother the painting and he's like, you know, like that's or when they're burying the body and he's like, oh, I got a chicken wing. Like there are a lot of funny moments in Scorsese movies sometimes. Oh, I was going to say something else while we're on it that I think Scorsese does differently in this movie than he has from his other, for lack of a better term, crime capers. I hate to refer to this as a caper, but it's not a caper, right? And I think that's one of the big differences is that, you know, if you watch a lot of his crime movies, Goodfellas, Wolf of Wall Street, there's a chunk of that movie where like crime's kind of fun, right? It's kind of cool. And it's like, you know, that opening scene, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster and him strolling through that nightclub like
make it flashy and desirable.
It glamorizes it. There's no other, by the end of that movie, all of the glamour has been stripped from it. And that's purposeful, right? Like he's like, yes, there is this very showy, glamorous aspect of it. And if it wasn't there, people wouldn't be drawn to it, right? Like heroin,
like Scarface, like in the end, it has to fall apart.
Heroin must feel great, or people wouldn't do it, right? Like it's where it takes you is awful, but if it didn't feel good at the beginning, no one would go down that road. This movie doesn't do that, right? This movie at no point is the crime ever fun or glamorized. No. It's always bleak and it's also fascinating that there is violence in this movie. It's very quick. It's very like there's flashes of it. It's not super gory. Like it's like where some of his other movies I think linger on the violence in a way that this one doesn't. It's there because it has to be because it's a story about violence. And if you tell a story about violence without violence, you're minimizing it. But if you tell a story about violence with too much violence, right now you made John Wick, and what are you doing, you know, in a story like this?
This is very respectful.
Yeah.
Very respectful to the participants, and it does not glamorize it, like you said. It's very difficult to watch because we are given a seat at the table with King and his family orchestrating all this, so it's very hard to watch, and you know that these innocent people are being murdered and their lives are being stolen and their money and families and generational everything is being taken away from them. So as we watch this happen, it's very difficult and sad to watch. And then also with Molly, when it points to her and how she's getting sicker and sicker, she's being poisoned, and again trusting Ernest, it's really hard to watch. And really respectful when it comes to the violence and everything, as much as you can be in telling a horrible story like this.
For sure. Yeah, I know that the Osage, like he went to the Osage people and like met with them and worked with them because he wanted to, you know, tell the story as accurately and respectfully as possible. I know some of them now are like, they're not lambasting the movie. I actually thought they had I really appreciated their nuanced take. Like they're like, they wish the movie had more aspects of Indian culture in it, but they also recognize, at least from the article I read, they also seem to recognize that wasn't the story that he was making at the same time, and that perhaps making it more mainstream will get this story to the people who need to hear it the most. Where if he made a movie that was all about Yeah. Like, if he made a movie that was just all about Indians, Indians would go see it, but the rest of America probably wouldn't.
This is the problem we have time and time again when you just, when you can't, I'm not saying this is them, the Osage people. I'm not using them specifically, but in general, this is the problem you have when someone goes, oh, I wish that it would have been this actor. Oh, I wish it would have been this director. Well, then the movie wouldn't get seen, unfortunately.
Right.
I mean, that's just, like, this movie is reaching, this movie is set to almost tie the Taylor Swift movie in Taylor's second week in release. That's huge to do, to get people in theaters to watch an adult film about historical events, and this movie is going to get seen because it's got Scorsese, it's got DiCaprio front and center, big on the poster, you got De Niro back there. That's just how it is, and I know one of the complaints
and this
was,
movie was,
oh, I wish it...
This movie was $200 million to make. This movie does not get $200 million without De Niro, DiCaprio, Scorsese. Like this.
Yes. And then producing it.
Because I also, looking at this movie, I'm like, how was this movie $200 million? Like, this movie did not need to be $200 million.
COVID. Like, I mean, it has to be like location and COVID troubles.
Yeah.
You know?
Because I don't see $200 million on the screen. Sorry.
No, I don't think it's a particularly great-looking movie. I'm sorry. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I don't necessarily think it's a masterpiece. I mean, it's just one of the puzzles, but I don't think it looks that great. Fascinating story. Never looked at my watch to, like, check, you know, on board or anything like that. But sometimes, you know, we talk about cinematography. We talked about Greg Fraser, who did the Creator, and obviously Dune and Rogue One and all those, and, you know, and Deakins and Cundy and all these cinematographers. We talk about the amazing pictures that we're seeing on the big screen, and while this movie was interesting, I didn't ever really look at it and go, oh, that shot was gorgeous. It's just not a great looking movie like that.
Yeah,
you know,
it's hard to say because it's like what they're filming is so dreary and dirty. Like, they're not, you know what I mean, like it's just a dusty kind of gross town, you know.
Yeah, and you don't want to glamorize it. Yeah, totally. I'm not necessarily critiquing it that hard because of that, but it's just I hear some people saying, oh, this movie looked beautiful and this and that, but like the movie Hell or High Water, I don't know who the cinematographer was for that, and I know it's a more modern western, but like that movie had some gorgeous shots in it, right? And there's terrible subject matter and robberies and crimes being committed or whatever, but like I can tell you that was a good looking movie. And so I don't know, just to me, the look of the film, I think it fit the time period. Like, they did a good job for the story they were telling, but it did not seem as cinematic. I think that's the only word I can use, and it's weird to say about a Scorsese film that, again, I did like, but it didn't feel as cinematic as some of his movies that are big and cinematic. And it just, but it's a different story, right?
For sure.
But yeah, so the family's getting killed off. It, you know, and obviously we're skipping over a lot of the little details. It's a long movie, but her
for
sister,
sure.
Anna, is killed off, who is the mother's favorite. The mother is obvious. She's up there in age, and she is sick. And I don't think they show in the movie, but the documentary said that it was believed she was being poisoned to be killed off. So, and she's hallucinating, much like Molly will later in the film. But Anna's her favorite, and she's a partier. She's a drinker. She's been divorced, and she's just out there partying it up. So, like, that's the first big murder in this family. We've heard of other ones from people in the town, but Anna's killed. Her body's found in a creek, and she's been shot in the head, where she's, you know, hardly identifiable, where it's just gruesome and everything. And we see later that this was, you know, Hale and the brother Byron. Brother Byron took her there and then hired the guy we talked about, who was like, if I adopt the kids, can I get the money and all that? He was the one that we end up finding in testimony that he took her out there and just shot her right in the back of the head. And then so now one of the daughter's sisters died. Was it consumption was the sickness, or she was wasting away with some kind of illness, but she died. Then there was the murder of Anna. And then, the other one was blown up in the house. Right. So that was Bill. You have this character, Bill Smith, another white man who was married to.
Yeah. He seems to be having his own murder conspiracy going on. Right. Cause he's married to a sister who dies and then turns around and marries another sister. Right.
Right. Like, it's very convenient. But it also makes you question, too, that, like, if this is your family and then they're with you during this hard time, I could see, like, comforting each other, because like, who else are you gonna turn to? So I think they leave it kind of questionable, like, is he, because he confronts DiCaprio, he confronts Ernest, and it's very much like, but what do
but you could also read that as like, hey, you're horning in on my thing, right? Like, it's,
but I don't know, like, but also this is told from the perspective of Ernest and King Hale, and he,
right.
Hale is the one going, that's your money, Ernest, and Bill is trying to take what's rightfully yours. He's convincing him, who is also the POV of the story mainly, and so I think that's Hale's spin on it. But I'm not saying Bill was honest and a great guy, but we don't see that. We never see Bill's POV. It's just Ernest and
it's
Hale
just,
and all them.
I will just say, in this age of this time frame of white people marrying Indians to get their oil rights, that he ended up married to two, but he's the one guy that was genuinely in love with her, with both of those women. It seems highly unlikely, perhaps not enough to convict him in a court of law, but I'm definitely giving him side eye.
Sure. But he did try to investigate all these murders. And if he was doing anything nefarious, I would think he would maybe not want to uncover so many of these details. Like they need to kill him off. And of course the other sister getting more of her shares, but they do need to take him out, because one of the major plot points is that he is doing his own investigation. And he's like, I know the details. He says he knows who the killer is, and he will unveil it at the right time, which would lead to Hale and Byron and all that. So I don't know, to me it's, we don't get a lot of his side, but I am led to believe that he is a better person than these other guys. That's at least from, you know, all things relative.
He's certainly killing fewer people, if he's killing people at all.
Killing fewer for sure. So they end up, Ernest is tasked with basically finding people to kill this family. And Ernest, again, they paint him as a dummy, and he keeps screwing it up. He goes and he hires these people who are not very capable, and one of them is Henry Roan, played by William Below, who is really good, I think, in this role too. He is Hale's neighbor, like longtime neighbor, 20-30 years, and he's very friendly with him, but Hale ends up taking an insurance policy out on him like a month or two before he wants to get him killed. And he wants Henry's murder to look like a suicide, because Henry is suicidal. He is melancholy, as they say, and he's tried to kill himself before. And come to find out, he was actually married to Molly, Ernest's wife, and, you know, the main sister we follow, in a ritual when they were 20 or in their teens, very young, and they had been since divorced. But there's this kind of like weird tension, and he's sad because he's not with her, and now she's with the white people, and that kind of follows throughout the film. But long story short,
like, this whole thing has disrupted his life, right? Like, it's this injection of white people into Osage culture has completely derailed the trajectory of his life. I also think it's fascinating that, like, there's this sequence where Hale has to prevent him from killing himself, because he took out an insurance policy on him, but if he kills himself too soon, suicide would void the policy. So he's got to keep him alive for a certain amount of time, and then he can die by suicide.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, I mean, you see how terrible of a person Hale was. He was like a super villain. He was planning of decades of this plan and taking these people out systematically is horrible. But yeah, so he wants it to look like a suicide when the time's right. And Ernest goes and he finds a guy who's like working in the oil fields or whatnot, or mining or something. And he basically tells him, like, I need to find someone that can do this. And he's like, I don't know where this guy is, whatever. And so he's like, you do it. And so he hires this guy who I think is really good. There's a lot of really good character actors in this movie. I didn't recognize the actor, but I thought he was really good in the role. And, he had like this really distinct feature. I think he had a fake eye, or at least he did in the movie. I don't know. He just had a look about him, and he was really good in this role. But he reluctantly decides to do it because he's going to get money out of it. And he befriends Henry. And because he starts to be friends with this guy, he can't bear to kill him from the front and make it look like he shot himself like a suicide. So he shoots him in the back of the head, which clearly is a murder. And so he screws that one up. And then Hale gets really mad, and he and Byron take him to, like, I don't know, the Stonecutters or whatever, and he hits him with a paddle, and, you know, because he screwed that whole thing up.
Yeah.
And then he finds the guy that's going to blow him up. There's this guy that is known for blowing up safes and getting into them and stuff. And so he's kind of connected with the guy that kills Henry, and he eventually finds him and hires him to blow up Bill and Rita. Maybe
Rita.
Yeah, okay, good. Bill and Rita's house. So he takes them out, and eventually they do find him, and he plants the dynamite, blows the house up, so that takes care of another sister. And at this point, I think it is just Molly, and she has one other sister, right? There's one that's still alive, isn't there?
I thought at that point it was just her, because then the mom dies, and then that's where we get the scene of one of my favorite scenes, where as the plan is starting to unravel, Hale goes to Ernest and is like, well, just to be safe, you should probably sign over your head rights to me in the event that something happens to you. And now all of a sudden he's like, it all consolidates to me, and then they take me out, right? And so the realization on his face is great.
Yeah, the way that, again, I really think De Niro did a good job in this movie, and he's such a snake, because this character was this guy was so terrible, and I think De Niro does a really good job of that. I'm your friend, I'm your uncle, I'm your, you know, I'm just one of the family, and he portrays that really well, and always has a smile on his face. And another thing that I really like is that De Niro doesn't go too big in this movie. I don't think it's cartoony, but he never gets big. So when they're in the jail cell, I think it would be really easy for a lesser director and a lesser actor, as soon as DiCaprio goes, I'm going to testify and I'm going to do all this stuff, for him to get, well, this is going to mean the end of your life and blah, 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 and you're making a huge mistake. You don't know who you've messed with. And Hale is basically like, now, come on now, son. You don't want to do that because, you know, like
it's not threatening. It's logical, right? Like, he's like, hey, here's what you're setting into motion. Like, you know, is that really the road you want to go down?
And he does threaten him, but like it's that underhanded, like now it's like that. I don't, not saying he says this, but it's that, like, now we wouldn't want anyone to get hurt here. It's that kind of threatening,
right?
Where he basically is saying, like, your life is going to be over, and they're not going to help you. It's lies. They're going to put you in jail as soon as you turn state's evidence or what. Not that he says that, but, you know, so to speak. And
I mean, basically, he's like, you can't trust the federal government. Why would you trust the government? Yeah. Like, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure there are many conversations going on like that.
So,
right now.
So I like his performance in that regard. So basically what happens is that Molly is on her deathbed. Her mother sees an owl before she dies. And I like how it flips from, you think it's like a totally spiritual thing, and I'm not saying it isn't spiritual, but knowing that she was supposedly poisoned and then Molly's getting poisoned, it's more of a hallucination than a spiritual thing. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. She saw the same owl, because I took it she was being poisoned the same way.
I think that's a fair take. Yeah.
Right. So I thought that was interesting how they did that. You think one thing and it's kind of a switch, but she's on her deathbed. She's basically about to die. She looks terrible. She's sick. But someone finds her while Ernest is out doing all these terrible things and this is going down. They find her. She goes to a hospital, and the doctor realizes that she's been getting poisoned. And so she's on the road to recovery. And this is, meanwhile, what's happening is they're doing the whole Jesse Plemons shows up, which I'm like, 2 hours into the movie, I'm like, isn't Jesse Plemons in this movie?
it took a long time. Yeah, it's like, and it's quite the flip from the book, because in the book, like, he's like the main character,
the guy. So he comes to town and he starts to investigate. Once the murders become clearly their murders, and then the federal government gets involved, sends him and the other agents. One guy does infiltrate, who says he has family that has blood relations with the Osage Nations. So he infiltrates and kind of goes undercover. I liked that aspect of it. And they're all working together to interrogate people and to figure out what's going on. And they have them all dead to rights. They've gotten enough evidence where they they know that that Hale and his family are committing these crimes, but they go to DiCaprio and they're like, you know, testify against him because we know what's going on here. And the only way you're going to be with your family is to, you know, is to take down Hale, who is clearly the kingpin and orchestrating all this. And at first he's going to, and it gets right up until trial. And I'm sorry to say, the other problem I had was Brendan Fraser's performance. I think it was
that was like from a whole other movie. I don't know if that's how that lawyer was in real life, but that was weird.
it was weird, right? And the way it was filmed was weird, that it felt like, I mean, I get trying to be claustrophobic, but it looked weird because the scene starts and then he just instantly is like yelling at the top of his lungs, and it's like
bellowing.
He was like doing a and I like Brendan Fraser, and I think he gave an excellent performance in The Whale, and you know, you could just see the hurt in his eyes. I think that was a personal story and character for him. The guy is a good actor, clearly talented, and can do great stuff, but I think his performance here was way over the top, way too like stage actory, like just I'm angry, so I'm yelling and this and that. So I don't know. You got people going, you know, people are dumb if they don't get it. He's amazing in this movie, but I did not care for his performance in this.
Yeah, agreed. It was a little weird.
But anyway, so they get right to court, and essentially what he's saying once Ernest comes to. It sounds like an Ernest movie. Ernest goes to court. once Ernest is about to go to jail, he goes to trial and he's going to testify against Hale. And Brendan Fraser's character, the lawyer, is like, "That is my client. I haven't had time." Now, I'm not yelling, but imagine him yelling. "I haven't had time to talk to my client and confer with him." And then everyone's looking around. John Lithgow is another lawyer on the other side, which I didn't recognize him at first, but I heard his voice. I'm like, "Oh, what, John Lithgow's in this?" And he's like, this is against the rules. Like, this is crazy. What is going on here? Conflict of interest. And he's just yelling and saying, "I need to talk to him," or whatever. And then Ernest is looking around, and he's still... I think Hale is still in his head, and he's like, "I don't know if I can trust the FBI. Maybe this guy will help me, and we'll all live happily ever after." And so he basically says, like, "Yeah, I'd like to hear him out." And that's when we get that scene where the whole town, all the white men are surrounding him, the bankers, the doctors, everybody is there, including this lawyer who does some more yelling. And they basically tell him, like, yeah, the FBI, this is again where he's like, "You're dumb. You don't understand, but they're going to screw you over. And we're your only family, and you don't want to do this to poor King, who would die in jail and old age and all this stuff." And they essentially convince Ernest not to flip. And so he goes to Jesse Plemons' character, Tom White, and he says, "I'm not going to do it." Oh, but before that, he gets out. The feds are all surrounding the house. He's home with Molly, and Molly at this point is looking at him, and she still embraces him when he gets done with the court scene. But you can tell again with her eyes, she's like not quite believing it, because now she's better. And who is giving me the insulin shots? Like Tom said, Ernest was pretty much the one in charge of it, and here I am getting poisoned. And so she talks to him, and she says at this dinner table, like their last time together, she says, "Was there more than insulin? Were you?" And Ernest says, "No, it was just insulin." And she knows that's a lie. Like, that's no way around it. That's a lie. So she can't trust him. He's betrayed her, and that's that. But he tells her, like, "I'm going to be..." This is a little out of order, but that's basically the main end of their relationship. But he turns himself into Tom White, and he says, "I'm not going to testify." He goes to jail. He has that scene with De Niro in the jail cell that we talked about. And essentially, something in his head changes, right? Like, he just realizes that it's not right what he's been doing and all these murders. Like, does he have any specific thing that triggers a change of heart?
I don't remember one, and I don't think anyone really knows. I think that's one of the that might be the biggest mystery, is what changed that made him decide to testify. I don't know, but he does, and that's the linchpin that puts them in jail, especially in a time when it's really hard to get.
Oh, his daughter dies. Their youngest daughter dies, and I do think that has some kind of an effect on his. I think with all the killing and death that's happened, when his daughter is killed, I think that changes something in him, where like he feels like he wasn't there to help her, or look how horrible it is when someone you actually care about dies. But that did strike a chord with him in one way or another. But he then ends up saying, like, "Okay, I am going to testify." And he tells Hale. Hale says, "Don't do it," blah, blah, blah. But he does. And he testifies and they Hale goes to jail. And then I think Ernest goes to jail. Wow, that doesn't sound right. Ernest is incarcerated, right? Even though he turns, he doesn't get the immunity he was once promised.
Like, I don't know that they ever promised him immunity. Like, you know, like a lot of times you just get lesser time, right? Like, it's like, well, yeah. So I don't think he was ever promised immunity. I think it was more just like, well, instead of going to jail for life, you'll go to jail for 10 years or something like that. So he still ends up in jail
or something. Yeah. Okay.
And yeah. Got it. So but I like the ending of the movie, the frame and sequence of the old time radio show.
I do too.
And I think that that's a great way to give people like the postscript. I thought Scorsese reading the last part was
exposition.
Was a little cheesy, but I did like getting the wrap up in the old time radio show.
It just shows my people's fascination with true crime.
Yeah. Was not invented by podcasting. Yes. And I'm trying to remember what it said. It might have even been the show I was talking about, that G-Man show where it was like the third episode or whatever. This might have been that. But I think my favorite part – favorite is harsh, but my favorite part of that particular sequence, the old-time radio, is when the white guy reads the Indian dialogue. Because I'm like – I was glad they didn't make the concession to modern times, because that's exactly what it would have been. And it was brutal to watch. And I think it was – I think it made – it was important for people to see it. Like when people talk about why can't this actor do this or why can't that actor do this, when you see it actually happen within a movie that's not doing it, it was jarring in a good way.
Yeah, like you don't – really, to put it in perspective, at least for me, like you don't see Hank Azaria voicing Apu when you see Apu in The Simpsons.
Right.
I think to watch him voice would be very different and uncomfortable. So sometimes you don't really understand it until you see it. And you're right. It is very uncomfortable, and it should be. And that's exactly how it would have played out. So you're right. But I really like what they were saying, because Scorsese is not innocent of this too, because even though this story is important and needs to be told and everything, but the fact is that more people are interested in things that have to do with murder and mysteries and crime and all that. And it's like, we're all guilty of it to some extent. And that's one reason why a lot of people are going to see this movie, is because it is kind of a crime thriller mystery. And like you said, it's been going on since these old timey radio days, that people's fascination in this. And so I do like it. It was a good framing sequence. I don't know how you would have ended it better. It gave you the exposition or the details of it while keeping it in a somewhat interesting
cinematic style. Yeah. Cause just blocks of text of like, this is what happened to this person. It would have been way too much. It would have been overwhelming. So, but overall, I really like this movie.
Clever. Yeah,
it was. And I really like this movie. I thought it was really good. Like I agree that I don't think it's quite a masterpiece, but it was definitely good.
Yeah, I think some of the performances hold it back. I think the look of it to an extent holds it back. I think the runtime, again, it was long. It did not feel boring, but I do think some things could have been cut to where this would have been a 3-hour movie. I really don't. But at the end of the day, you know, it's Scorsese. He's getting up there. He gets to make the movie he wants to make, and I do think it was a very interesting story.
Agreed. So, well, anyway, I guess that's it for this one. We'll go around the virtual table and we'll tell each other where to find each other.
Sure. This is Kevin. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett. And the second episode is mentioned last week of Circle of Wizards, which is myself and Matt F. Bosler. We talk about video games, retro, old school games, some new stuff too. So check that out. And if you could subscribe and rate that show, you know, as it's small, that will help it grow tremendously. So thanks for listening to that.
And this is Tom. You can find me on Twitter at Roger Kubert, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online at facebook.com/RealSpoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, don't forget our Patreon. So anyway, that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Arnold's fireworks start the fire.
Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, because we already warned you. Better watch out. It's going to ruin the ride.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.